mindsets.
Everyone got one. What's your opinion? This is the rant room. Tongues won't be bitten. Ain't no rules, just spill it. And anybody can get it. No limit. We here to kill it. You tuning into the thrillers. And no, ain't no stopping. Any topic, even the random.
We get to win.
I hope that you ready. We entering in the zone soon. We on a grown shit. Welcome to the rant room.
That's it. That's all I got to say.
I love that shit.
That's it. That's all I got to say.
A little funky little accent. What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you're listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it street, we keep it opinionated, and we keep it 100. I love that. You've been practicing.
Hello, I haven't. Hello, fam. What it do?
So on this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is usually screenwriting, stories, craft, shit like that.
Yes.
So you guys hear her voice. That's my girl, mm-hmm. Lisa Bolakaja. The what?
The one and only.
Why are you the one and only? Because you're street nerdist?
Yeah, street nerdist.
Why they call you street nerdist, little girl?
Well, because, you know, sometimes they need to understand that people, you know, it's like the rap song, you know, started from the bottom and now we at the top. We all here. Yes. And, you know, I'm street and I'm nerdy. You know, I'm just me.
She's just a combination of street and nerdy, so you don't want to fuck with her. That's what it is.
You never know what's
okay, she'll catch you. Yeah, she'll catch you. So look, y'all listen to the Screenwriters Rant Room. So look, if you're grown, let's get it in.
Buckle up.
So today, we're going to do a special episode for you guys today. We're going to do one on being fearless.
Because we got some issues okay. that we need to deal with.
So let me tell you.
All right, break it down.
So I walked in this morning. And
did you not just pop my?
I popped my lip.
Okay.
Pop my tongue. So I walked in today, and I'm like, Lisa, okay, we gotta do one. We gotta go in today. Now most people know me. I'm not somebody who gets depressed. I'm not depressed, but I'm going through like a little thing where I need to look back into my being fearlessness, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Being fearless.
You know. Mm-hmm. So Lisa came up with this topic. I think it's brilliant. And I'm like, okay. So, I'm going through a couple things. I got a bunch of projects going on. I got a bunch of possibilities happening, which we all can probably relate to. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you wake up, and it's on a day when every little one of those things come back and tell you no. Mm-hmm. You know, when it looked like yesterday was a yes, mm-hmm. and then today is a no.
Right.
So, I'm like, Lisa, we got to go in about this. Mm-hmm. You know, and she said, well, let's talk about being fearless. Let's go in. Let's really have this discussion about mm-hmm. what that means to keep going, mm-hmm. even when you feel like mm-hmm. maybe I shouldn't be doing this shit, mm-hmm. right? Now, I'm not saying that, but I'm just gesturing. Right. So let's talk about that a little bit today.
Yes. Well, I think it's interesting because for me, one of the struggles I deal with, because most of the time I try to think of myself as being fearless in terms of what I do with my life compared to a lot of my friends who aren't writers. Mm-hmm. But one of my problems, and it's something that I deal with, because I do deal with depression.
Sure.
You know, and being a creative person, you know, most of the time we do. But I do have these moments where I just kind of curl up and I can't do anything. And it's mm-hmm. something that I've been dealing with for like years. I've gotten really good at coping with it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I have to get over, and I know a lot of it comes from my own perfectionism. I have a serious problem with being a perfectionist. And I'll be honest with you, this has been crippling for me because I come from a background, and I say this a lot on the show, and I joke because I am black.
No, you are not.
I am black on purpose every day. I'm like the old school. I'm like the generation. They call it, a lot of my friends, my old.
You
old
one of them? School. You one of them 69 sisters?
Oh my God! No. It's funny because I've always attracted to older people, mm-hmm. and so a lot of the people that I hang around with are like old heads, like old Black Panthers and old Pan Africanists and old like the people who are the old race people, like mm-hmm. you know that hardcore. Because there's just something so. I don't know if it's romantic to me, that whole idea that they have this purpose in their life and they're struggling for something good, sure. whereas I come from a generation that we kind of benefited from that labor, mm-hmm. and I think we got kind of complacent, mm-hmm. but I was still around enough older people who were always putting it into my head that you got to be the best. And coming from a black background, that means having to be better than anybody else. And that's crippling, because you have to understand historically, oh, yeah. in order for black people to be accepted, we had to give up a lot of cultural things mm-hmm. to be accepted. And basically, I hate to say it, is to act as white as possible. And one way to do that is to
what
be
do you
better.
Mean, act as white as possible.
To act as that means that we. Well, I grew up where we could not use slang in the household. Mm-hmm. To this day, my mother still corrects me. I think that's the reason why I use a lot of slang now, and I relax a
it's
lot of my language.
Rebellion
it
or
is. You know. You know what? Honestly, it is, because when mm-hmm. I'm just normally talking, mm-hmm. it's that Southern Cali Black Valley mm-hmm. girl, mm-hmm. and a part of me slips
into
stuff.
You do talking questions like
I
Valley
do,
girl.
I know. I go in and out. And I think subconsciously, it's just a rebellious act against my mother from having that ingrained in me. Like, you have to enunciate, because no one's going to take you seriously if you're mm-hmm. talking that street talk. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's respectability politics. What it comes down to is stop acting like those black people, because black people are not valued. I'm just talking about my own personal baggage I deal with. Mm-hmm. And because of that, one way to get over is to be better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that was the survival technique. Mm-hmm. If you are better than anybody else, there's no way that people can deny you or tell you can't have or do anything. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that perfectionism, for me, it cripples me, because a lot of times I won't submit work, especially with my fiction writing. A lot mm-hmm. of times I won't submit stuff out because I don't think it's good enough. Mm-hmm. And I need to have it be the best it can be, because in my mind I'm still running that tape of you got to be better than anybody for them to even sure. be equal. Mm-hmm. You got to be better. So a lot of times for a lot of black people, to even be just average mm-hmm. means you have to be above average, because mm-hmm. black people are not allowed to be average mm-hmm. in this country at all.
No.
You got to.
You have to excel to the top.
To be on par with just mm-hmm. the most basic mm-hmm. white person, you know. For black people, you got to be just to be even in the room. And so I deal with a lot of that, because I know a lot of people who are submitting some things and getting things published. When I read it, I'm like, man, my shit was better than that. What? I should have just went ahead. But I keep running that fear-based mm-hmm. tape of perfectionism. If it's one thing's not right, it's not so much they're going to look at you as a bad writer. They're going to look at you as a bad writer, and you're black. I mean, that's the type of baggage that I carry.
I mean, I can relate to that, because I remember when I first started writing, one of the things that kept me from doing it for so long, and I had thought that I would do it at one point while I was an actor, you know, back in the 90s, and I was like, oh, but I can't do that. I didn't graduate from high school. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought you had to be college educated mm-hmm. and all that stuff. You know, it took me years to realize that I didn't need to, mm-hmm. but it also did the exact same thing. It crippled me in a way, because I got so locked into being a writer mm-hmm. that any book that came out, any class that came out, I went and learned it.
Right.
Because Paul Haggis studied here. This right. person studied there.
Right.
You know what I mean? They all are like so super smart with all these PhDs and graduate, you know, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, I don't have that. I don't have time for that. I can't afford that. So what can I do? Otherwise, I got to be that good.
Well, that's interesting you know what I mean? Say that, because coming from a lot of my friends, lots of my friends graduated and went on to like really prestigious Ivy League. I mean, I have friends graduated from Columbia, mm-hmm. Harvard, you know, Stanford, high mm-hmm. end. And it's funny when I would go visit them, because I came from San Diego State, because, you know, I didn't have the money to go to those. I was quite capable of getting into those schools.
I'm sure.
I just did not have the money to do that. Mm-hmm. And there was just no way. There was mm-hmm. nothing. Unless I was going to be pimping somebody out.
You know, I told you you should have been pimping.
Because I do have the pimp mindset. I must confess, I do. And at 17, I seriously thought, like, you know what? I can probably get something. These brothers can't run nothing. I can, like, come up in here. But that's just me. I digress. But going and visiting my friends at these higher institutions of learning, you would be amazed about how dumb some of these people are. Mm. So that was kind of like really satisfying for me. Not because mm-hmm. people are stupid, mm-hmm. but because it freed me up a little bit to realize, just because somebody went to some high-end school, they got degrees up the wazoo.
I think you're one of the people who slapped that into me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Shit fades. Mm-hmm. Look, mm-hmm. those degrees fade. True. Okay? That knowledge mm-hmm. is ongoing. There are people who I admire who did not go to high-end university, but they're the smartest people on the planet, because mm-hmm. they are self-taught and they're mm-hmm. constantly learning. Mm-hmm. And those people who keep up, like you're saying, going to those classes and getting the new books, those people who got those degrees are not doing that, you know?
Because they think they know.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not saying that not going to a high-end university is not cool, because, you know, there's the prestige that goes with that. Mm-hmm. But there's also from being, from intermingling and hanging mm-hmm. out with people and going to social events with these people, you know, it doesn't mean, for me personally, it don't mean nothing. You can come up with the biggest degree. I don't give a fuck. If you're not interesting and you're boring and you're basic, mm-hmm. a degree is not going to make you any better. That degree is just a way to weed people out. You got to mm-hmm. remember, we live in a capitalist system and we need to have the sense of us and them. And those high university degrees and things like that, that's just a way to weed people out. So do not feel fear. Well, against people who go to these big schools.
Oh, no. And I think that is partly why, and I kind of teach the reverse of it now, but I always tell young writers, you know, why, I think that's why I started doing the screenplay competitions and everything, right. was to put something up under my script.
Right.
You know, now it's like a script that went to Sundance. Now right. it's a script that was, you know, a quarterfinalist or semifinalist at Nichols or whatever mm-hmm. the fuck. And when I started getting the feedback, yes, you are good enough. Out of thousands of people, you're in the top 10. Mm-hmm. Out of thousands of people, you won first or second place. Whatever it was, I was like, wow. So, okay, I didn't go to college, but I still was able to do this. Mm-hmm. And it started helping my ego mm-hmm. to an extent. Because still today, I still submit every blue moon. Maybe once a year, I'll right. do one just to test myself.
Right.
You know? And because I've learned over the years that even though I'm a working writer now and a lot of people do know me, mm-hmm. it still makes more sense for me to have a script that won or was a finalist at Austin than it is for me to just have a script.
Right.
So
right.
every blue moon, I will submit to one of those to see
fun.
How I
honestly,
do.
Honestly, they're fun.
You know what I mean?
There's that excitement of sending it out yeah. there and seeing what happens. Like, to me, that's like one of those ongoing, because a lot of times people who, and I'm pretty sure there's like pros out there who are still submitting mm-hmm. to contests and stuff just to see where they place, just to kind of get an idea where sure. they are, that kind of fun stuff. But I think on another note on that, on top of the fact when we talk about, you know, being fearless, mm-hmm. one of the other problems I have personally is, and I struggle, and I think I'm getting better, but I do have a problem. There are certain stories I want to write in a screenplay that I'm hesitant to write because mm-hmm. I'm nervous about the material. And I'm nervous
what
about
do you mean, like
how
what?
People... Like, there's a script, a story I've been having for... I had it for a long time. Mm-hmm. The last 8 years. And I remember I had a producer that actually wanted to see a script mm-hmm. on that. Like, there was one script I've submitted, and then I had, like, a couple of log lines and a synopsis. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, we want to see that one. I think it was my Bitches Brew. I call it Bitches Brew after Miles Davis. That's just the working title. Mm-hmm. But it was about a female pimp. Mm-hmm. And it was dealing with the sex worker trade. Mm-hmm. Because people have, like, these notions of what sex work is and what's really going on. And they really have no idea with
sure.
the sex trafficking, all the stories that were coming out, especially out in Los Angeles, where people were like finding out like, oh my God, there were like women who were enslaved in these in suburban areas. Mm-hmm. They look like regular people who lived there, but mm-hmm. they were really like, you know, forced sex workers. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between those who are forced to do the work and those women who choose willingly. And sure. I've always wanted to write a script that deals with those women who do sex work mm-hmm. Professionally, who choose to do it, who are faced with certain dilemmas in their life. And I'm just really curious about that world and fascinated.
So we see the human side of them.
Yeah, and plus there's like these clubs, like literally I had booked a ticket to go and then I chickened out because I got scared. Mm-hmm. I have booked these sex clubs in other countries. There's a place I want to go to in Germany, which is basically, I'm just letting you know, it's a special, like, it's like a high-end place okay. where people are allowed to live out their sexual fantasies, okay. and I wanted to go there to interview the people who ran it, because mm-hmm. I really wanted to get some type of insider information to the mindset of these people. And these are people who make lots of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was doing a lot of research on bondage, S&M, just mm-hmm. I mean, that's just how my mind works. I'm fascinated by it.
You're a freak, that's all.
I am. I mean, yes, I am not ashamed to say that. But I'm not afraid of that. But mm-hmm. I was afraid of writing that in a script.
Okay.
Because I didn't want to be known for writing that type of material, you know, and getting and labeled. Kind of, I don't know. There's just something in the fear that I have to get over. And I was not fearless in that one aspect of writing the script because I was just so fascinated by the. I remember getting a ticket, and I ended up like trading. I got like an open ticket where you can trade it and go someplace else if you needed to. And I remember getting emails, and remember having to have somebody help translate because the people were German, and I was trying to let them know that I'm a writer. And I was just, you know, I was watching documentaries on these fascinating places that people go and. I just wanted to get into that world see what it was. And then I got afraid. Yeah. And I don't know if it was because, one, I was embarrassed of the material, or two, maybe subconsciously I thought, I'm going to go and I'm going to end up working there and I'm never going to come back to America. I'm going to be Dominatrix Lisa. You know, and so I'm like...
Live out my wildest dreams.
Live out my life. And just have these crazy places and adventures. And I chickened and I should have gone. And to this day, I think I need to go back and deal with that. But that fear of writing something I really am interested in, but I think I'm just afraid of judgment on the material, you know? Because I tend to be fearless about everything else, but it's just like in that one aspect of a story that I really want to tell, I can't get past that, you know?
Then didn't that sounds like... Now, did you grow up in the church at all?
Thank you, Jesus, no.
Okay. I was just wondering.
But I was one of those types that my mother was born in a very my grandparents were very religious.
Okay.
So really strong Baptist, Methodist background where they
Though you didn't have to go to church, it still was in the house.
My mother, we would go like on Christmas and Easter, and every now and then the little Salvation Army little truck would come by and pick up us little low income kids and come take us around. And so my mother felt that it was important to be baptized and to go to church occasionally, but because of her experience with it, she didn't force it on us. And I think that was a blessing in disguise because I think it allowed me to be a more freer thinker.
Sure.
Although I grew up around a lot of people who are religious. So even though it's funny, I can be in religious environments and I can fit right in.
I'm just curious because you're talking about being fearless. Because you actually, to me, are somebody who is fearless for the most part that I know of. So it just made me think about, was that part of it? Because it's usually something that people who come from that background are fighting and battling of,
or maybe
should I or shouldn't I? People are going to judge me. Oh my God, what are they going to think?
I think now that I've said it out in public, I was like, I'm probably going to get over it now.
Okay, you blasted it
now. But I think what it is, I think honestly, what it is the fear of what people would think of me. They would see that maybe I am that freaky. Maybe I am that weird. Because the subject matter I'm touching upon, it's some pretty heavy stuff.
Let me ask you, what's the difference between that and all the other crazy horror sci-fi?
Because sex work...
People getting killed, paranormal shit that you write.
Sex work is real.
Yeah.
And I think I want to respect the women that choose to do it. But at the same time, I want to be cautious and not overlook and disrespect those who are forced to do something, especially when it's coming to deal with like with children and sex work. There's a huge industry of that.
Sure.
And it's that fine line. And I don't want to come off as thinking that I'm okay with that. There's certain aspects that I'm curious about, I'm interested in, but I'm just worried that people will think that, oh, she just thinks that's okay. It's the same kind of argument.
I think as long as there's somebody in your script who's a voice of reason.
I do have characters that are like that.
You know what
that.
I mean? Then it answers the
question. But my protagonist is someone who has grown up, whose father is a pimp, who has grown up in a lifestyle, who has one-upped and done better than her father in the business because she has branched out into other things.
Okay.
And her dilemma is coming across some people who are dealing with certain aspects of the business that she's not interested in.
Okay.
But my fear is exploring that and not giving credence to it and making it think it's okay. It's the same, you know, I'll put it this way. It's the same internal conversation I had with myself when I wrote my Blanco script.
Okay.
When I was writing about Griselda Blanco, who's a real person who did these horrible things, but I'm fascinated by her gangsterism purely from like a feminist gaze in terms of this woman doing this. But at the same time, I was worried about, well, I'm writing about all these horrible things, but fucking real people got killed and lives were ruined because of this woman. I don't want to glorify her.
But at the
same time, I'm like so
fascinated.
But
what's the difference between that than Michael and the Godfather? I mean, what's...
Because he's not real.
I think you're putting too much on the realness.
Maybe I am.
Because...
And Al Pacino is sexy.
You're going to humanize them.
Michael Corleone is sexy.
No, but you're going to humanize her and make her have... Remember... Bad people don't think they're bad. As we all know.
I know that.
You preach that all the time.
I love bad people.
She does not think she's
bad.
Which
is
horrible. So there's no reason you can't, like, her love for her kids, it's something we never see.
Right.
All we hear about is how she would send her kids off to go kill, yada, yada, yada. But what about the love between them that made them go, I'm willing to die for my mom, that we haven't seen?
I think I need to make sure that when I do write the script, I'm thinking about doing it next year because I still want to interview some people, and things have changed now with social media.
You got a TV series right there.
And just dealing with that, and there's so much new information. I just want to make sure that I'm respectful of people whose lives have been affected by it. That's just my own thing, because clearly it'd be really easy for me to write that and not give a shit. Like, oh, well, shit happens, and this is a great story. But that part of me who realizes that stories are so important. I know we did an episode that talked about why do people write and how stories resonate. I want to make sure that I'm not putting a certain message for people to take it and think that I think that certain things are okay. I'm just purely coming at it from a writer's fascination with character. And that part of me is just really sensitive to real world issues. And I just have to get past that. I mean, I eventually did write the Blanco script and got over it and did what I did.
Yeah, no doubt.
I just need to do the same thing and get past that fear and just tell the story I want to tell and fuck everybody else. What do
you think? I think you have to. I think as long as you have a character that if there's something really, really, like they make the detective who's against Blanco, for instance.
Right.
He wants to take her down.
Right.
So he's the voice of the opposite, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So as long as you have somebody who represents the world.
What if I want to just tell a story and not have that character? And that's the type, I think that's what I want to write. I want to write where there's, it's
here's
unapologetic.
The world, it's just what it
it's
is.
Just, it is what it is, and you will deal. And that's the world I want to write.
And to me, that's a script that's probably going to win Sundance.
But it's that me getting over that, the responsibility. Because I come from a tradition of being responsible for other people.
Yeah.
And how we, how things are displayed. And I just want to be respectful for the people and the women who do the work.
Now, okay, listeners out there, this is a really interesting. I'm so glad you're being vulnerable about talking about this.
I am.
This is
it's
great.
Like,
this is great.
I'm waving my freak flag,
because here's
and now you know.
Thing. We started this conversation with her telling her about myself being vulnerable about how I feel. But actually in talking to you about it, I'm feeling really good right now. So it's funny.
Oh.
Just in hearing you talk about how you're going through what you're going through, in me trying to talk you through it is making me think about my own self. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In a positive way.
Right.
But listeners, this is an interesting dilemma because I think we all have done it in our own way on some script about something that we were uncomfortable about talking about because people are going to think it's us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if you think about some of your favorite writers that you talk about, don't hold back. They give a fuck.
They put it out there.
You know, and that's why I made the comment that based off of what I know, and I know your writing is fucking awesome. If you write the story you're talking about with fuck them, despite the fact that there might be some uncomfortable shit in there.
Right.
I mean, look at you like, we had, what's his name on the show? Steven. And he was talking about he likes to write those dark, what's his name? What's the character, the filmmaker's name? And you were like, oh, I love him too. He likes to write those dark scripts with, what's his name?
So many good writers out there. I know.
Anyway, that he was naming some filmmaker that you loved that writes those weird, dark movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that person has he doesn't give a fuck.
Right, right.
Now, the movies aren't big time.
Right.
But he makes them. He has this little niche audience.
Right.
Everybody respects him.
Right.
And you're one of those people.
Right, right.
But you watch his movies and there's some odd, weird shit in some of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, why not today? I think we can handle a lot more than we thought we can handle.
I think intellectually,
yeah.
I know that.
Sure.
Emotionally, when I'm sitting in that blank page and like the script, the Bitches of Bruce script, I have the outline, I have the synopsis, and I wrote the script halfway and I just stopped because I just thought, I can't, this is, it's really it veering into some territory and I'm like, people are going to think it's me. And I'm like, well, Lisa, it is kind of you because you, that is your freakishness coming out on the page and you just need to own it, you know. Don't be ashamed of it because I'm sure there's other people out there who'd be interested in it. But it's like just getting past that. And I think it's just the old school respectability politics. And
I think that this is an interesting one because I know a lot of the writers out there can relate to what we're talking about right now. And I think that here's one of the cool things, Lisa, is we both are still in the independent world mm-hmm. where we can experiment. Mm-hmm. This is the place where you do.
Right.
Because once you get in, you're not going to be able to write a script like that. Mm-hmm. It's not commercial enough.
That's true. I know this. It's just
a script. You're just writing a script. You keep acting like the movie's coming out tomorrow.
That's just me visualizing. The movie's going to come out and do this. And
no.
I'm going to do it. I am going to do it.
And that's a thing for all of us writers. We need to write that script that's in us. Because mm-hmm. for all you know, based on how much you're withholding and holding it back, that's the one that's going to get you in watch. You know what I mean? You always hear that story about that person who was like, well, I wasn't sure, and bada yada yada, and I let it sit for 10 years, like the Dallas Buyers Club, mm-hmm. you know, was a script that he just kept sitting on and working on and finished and letting it sit or whatever, mm-hmm. and finally he got together with the woman writer, and they finally wrote it, mm-hmm. you know, and then boom, look at what it did. So, and he was uncomfortable about writing that.
You know? It's good to hear that, because literally that's what it is, because this character, even though her life is not like mine, her mm-hmm. thinking in terms of, and I really just wanted to write a script that dealt with like raw sexuality and deals with people's psychological uses of it, especially when we're talking about bondage. It's like a conversation I was having with a couple of friends, and we were just like joking around, like, well, you know, if you're doing the bondage world, and mm-hmm. you know, because you know, part of my research is dealing with these different sexual aspects. I mean, there's mm-hmm. so much sexual proclivities out there, and so many things that people are into that you wouldn't think was sexual at all, but mm-hmm. it's like subcultures within a subculture. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking about, why is it that people, the stereotype is always the person who's like the most dominant in their life mm-hmm. are the ones who need to be submissive, or the people mm-hmm. who are always submissive in their life are always the one they end up being dominant. And I used to be like in touch total denial about that.
That is interesting.
But to me, it is so true, because it's mm-hmm. like in that sexual aspect, mm-hmm. I not that I'm put my business out there on the street.
Come on, girl, put it out.
We're just talking about it. It's like I can be the most dominant person, but mm-hmm. there's nothing sexier than a dominant partner mm-hmm. who will talk shit to me, and I'll be like, all right, daddy, that's, you know, that.
I can relate to that.
You know what I'm saying? I understand that.
Because my partner will talk to me in a voice, and I'll be like, ooh, what was that?
You know, and certain things like where I would be like, no, but if you hit that certain tone or note, uh-huh. or sometimes I see it in different people that mm-hmm. I'm talking to, and your mind just goes there sometimes.
Sure.
And I'm like, man, I would just, if he just said the word right. And I thought, oh my God, this is going to go in my script. But it was like interesting things that. And sexuality in film is so taboo in America. Mm-hmm. You know, we would rather watch horror movies and war movies where body parts are being blown up, mm-hmm. but God forbid a penis shows mm-hmm. up on screen.
But that's American.
Yeah.
You know. I guarantee your movie in France or freaking Switzerland would freaking be, you know, you would make millions over in the box office.
And just put
so maybe
out
you
there.
Need to garner it to that.
I think that's where I'm going
to
have to
go. Maybe you need
to
make a European fucking movie.
You know what? I was thinking, because the originally, when I was thinking about writing, I really was thinking of it trying to make it mainstream. And I think that's probably why all of this baggage is coming.
Uh-huh.
It's like, what is the main? They're going to mm-hmm. look at me and I'm going to be pigeonholed as that weird mm-hmm. person who writes that. But I just need to write the script, be fearless in writing it, and just know that there's a certain audience for a certain thing and get it out there. And who knows? It could be one of those movies where 10 years from now, you know, that would be the one that people are like, yeah, we're so glad you made that movie because it did this. But I'm always interested in darker sexuality, mm-hmm. and I'm always interested in why people are attracted to certain things. And I'm very interested also in non-binary and non-gendered and non, you know, just male and female, because there's mm-hmm. so many different levels of sexuality. It was funny because we were having a conversation on, not conversation, but there was a hashtag we were talking about
on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And I follow some really fun people. Like I had this Sisters of Horror and also Black Girl Nerds. And we were talking about, oh, how we're attracted to, like, you know, in genre characters who we're attracted to. And we were like confessing on the mm-hmm. hashtag. And I like, after I put a couple of names out there, I was like, man, I really put some shit out there. Like, man, I am so embarrassed now. Because I was saying stuff like, yeah, I would sleep with, the Predator dude. Mm-hmm. I'd sleep with him.
That's hilarious.
You know, he's sexy. He's got body. He's got dreads. If he keeps the mask on, we all good. And then I was talking about Darkness Legend, Tim Curry. Uh-huh. Oh, my God, sexy with the horns. And we were like, so what would you do with the horn? Like, who cares about the horns? Look at him. And we were talking about Candyman and how sexy Tony Todd is and that cat. So we were, like, talking about how these hard, like, I'm in love with Pinhead. Mm-hmm. Yes, I said it. Mm-hmm. I think Pinhead from Clive Barker's Hellraiser is sexy as fuck. Pins and leather and Be My Victim and Tony Todd with the hook and can't. Oh, God. When he comes up and says, be my victim, it's like, we would strip. He can get the business with that
but
hook.
See, that ties into...
But that's
I know we're going
though.
All
that's
off, y'all, but this
fun,
is interesting.
Though.
But
no,
that ties
fun.
Into what you were just saying a few minutes ago about how some of the most dominant people are the ones who like to be dominated.
Right.
Because it's interesting that you and, like, the group of the Black Girl Nerds, you know, you guys are all the fanboy crowd, right? So, right?
We have our man flesh stuff on there.
Okay,
where
but
we
that's
just,
cute.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is you guys did a little flip. Instead of talking about, oh, my God, Blair Underwood or Idris Elba, which I know you like, too.
Oh, yeah.
But you guys are talking about, okay, if I were in a movie and I could be dominated by the evil whoever, it would be Hellraiser. It would be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just sexy.
That's interesting.
It's just sexiness. Yeah. Like, it's like the weird things that you don't think. It's like one of, because I know Black Girl was talking about, I can't remember the character's name, but it was just in Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the bad guy, the big bad guy, the one with the big chin. And I can't remember his name, but... I remember Nebula and Gamora and the other bad guy. Oh, and the bad guy from Guardians of the Galaxy, the dude with the blue, and he put, did you see Guardians of the Galaxy yet? Oh, my child. I can't
I
remember his name.
I just watched Maleficent, which I'm going to talk to you about,
too. Wait, wait, wait. He is so sexy. Like, both the bad guys in Guardians of the Galaxy, oh, my God, we thought they were so sexy. And it was like.
So y'all can look past the monster suit and shit.
But here's the thing. What I think subconsciously for me, the monster imagery, it's just a darker sexuality. It's a rawness, and it's someone who's embraced their sexuality. So when I see those types, when I talk about Pinhead, now, hell no, I don't really want to sleep with a demon coming up from hell, you know, that kind of stuff, and have hooks coming out of me. But what that represents, that darker, I don't want to even say darker, because we always say darker as a negative. It's not. It's just embracing that sexuality and embracing that newness, that weirdness. Like, that is such a turnoff for so many women. Like, I was amazed at how many women were on that hashtag.
But you're attracted to the confidence of it, though, because they are, like,
super confident. And it's and it's even, like, because it's funny, because, like, we're talking about Heimdall, Idris Elba on there. It's like, making it rain on Heimdall. We talk about these characters, and there's just something smoldering and sexy that's better. Like, Loki. I love Loki. Oh, my God, he's so sexy. And there's that. And it's like, Thor. Who can fuck about Thor? Yeah, he got buffed out. He got his little blonde dude. But there's nothing quite as sexy as Loki in his leather when he's talking. He just, you're just like, he could say anything to me and I would do it. And if Thor said it, it just wouldn't be sexy. It'd be corny. It'd be like, get out of here. Nobody wants to sleep with you. But, you know, it's just that embracing of those shadow sides of yourself, I guess. It's just it's just interesting.
Well, interesting, because I was thinking about being fearless. And I was just thinking about, I was mentioning to you before we started taping the show that I'm somebody, I don't usually get depressed. And usually it's because I work through it. Whenever I'm feeling like kind of how I was feeling earlier today, I would get, we're here in my office, I would go to the computer and I usually either watch something or I read something that gets my mind off.
Right.
And it's usually, you're going to laugh at me. It's usually a scene or two from 30 Days of Night or something, or one of my favorites, which is Day of the Dead with Ving Rhames and Mekhi Phifer. There's something about that movie that just makes me smile. I don't know what it is. Yeah, all the sequences are just perfect, on the money.
Wow.
And so is 30 Days. I mean, on the money. And it just makes me go, okay, I could do this. I could do this. You know, oh, I love how he said such and such.
Right.
Whatever it is, just makes me get into that mode. And I was thinking about how you were saying earlier about being better than. And I think that people always ask me, like, how is it that I write every day? And I'm like, well, even on the days when I can't write, like today would have been a day I couldn't write.
Right.
However, I would have listened or I would have read.
Right.
I don't let one of those days go by.
Right.
And I was thinking about something you guys said. We did an episode back with the Derek brothers, and they were talking about, Will Derek was talking about going to the beach, which is another something you do all the time.
All the time.
And he was saying, and I was going to ask you about this. I didn't want to have him elaborate on it at the time because we were kind of moving along. But he was talking about how he read something about the salt water does something to your – can you explain that a little bit? What was it? It was something. Because this might help people about getting out of their funk or whatever it is. Do you remember?
I don't know. It's just something about the salt – well, for me, I know the salt water, for me, it kind of purifies the body.
Okay.
The smell of it, the taste of it, being the salt of the earth. For me, it's like the whole ocean water, the air. It's just something cleansing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, one of my favorite Loas are, one of the gods, goddesses from West Africa is Yemanya or Yemaye, depending on what country you come from, which is the spirit of water. And for me, water is always purifying. And for me, when I am in a funk, I like walking and having the water touch my feet. I like the smell of the salt. The salt on the skin, it helps draws out toxins in the skin.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes the body much cleaner and purer and more, I think for me, psychologically, it makes me more receptive to thoughts and energy. Because a lot of time, my favorite thing to do is I'll put my iPod on, I'll take off my shoes, and I'll spend the whole day at the beach walking up and down with the water. I swim a lot, too, in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something cleansing. And I think what it happens is spiritually, it just opens me up to so many ideas. You'd be amazed at how many story ideas and stuff I get. Just the rhythm of my feet hitting the water, smelling that salt, and having that salty taste in my mouth. It just makes me feel good, and it makes me.
Do you look out at the water and think about the possibilities? You think it's
the
got waves, something
because,
to do with
and the
that
one thing that helps me a lot is too. It's like this ocean has been here since the beginning of time.
Okay.
This ocean's gonna be here after I leave.
True that.
This water is going to keep coming in and out. So whatever bullshit I'm dealing with right now, it don't really matter to this ocean. It's a matter of what I decide I'm going to do with that energy. Am I going to do this shit or am I going to just fuck around? Because the ocean is going to keep coming in and out.
You know what I always think about when I go to the ocean?
And it's not going
to
think about me.
This is totally off the subject. I always think about how the water comes into the sand, into the, what do they call it? Into the,
that is
the
sand.
Beach area,
right?
That water that comes in might have been the very first time that a human ever touched it. Because it keeps doing this.
Right.
It keeps recycling itself back out.
Right.
So you keep thinking about, yes, there's like 100 people on the beach, but every time it touches their leg, it's probably a person they've never touched it before.
Right, right.
You know what
I
mean? I've never, but I think about stupid shit like that.
No, I love it. And one of the things I always do is I always take like some sugar or a little piece of candy or something, and I always give an offering. And then I take the water and I actually pat it on my head. Right above the third eye, right above there. One is just to respect that one, my ancestors came across that water. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm one of those people, like so many black people here, who actually made it over.
There's plenty of ashes in the water.
I'm one of the ones, the few that actually made it over.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some who didn't. So it's kind of my way of honoring those people. And also knowing that those stories that those old enslaved Africans who wanted to see that future, who want to see me be where I am right now. It's just a way for me to pay homage and to let them know that, hey, I made it. And also there's something about the water. Water is like creativity, the water in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just something about those creative, dark waters that always makes me feel like I can do anything, that the possibilities are endless.
Okay.
And I need to be near water. Like I always tell people, just I can live anywhere in the world, but I have to be by a large body of water.
Lake, it could be something.
It has to be. If not, I don't function well at
Interesting.
All.
Interesting. Okay. Because I'm one of those victims who lives.
I'm a secret mermaid. I think originally my mother just found me on a beach somewhere and picked me up, and I just grew legs. And one day I'm going to return to the water. But water is healing, and water to me is creativity.
Okay. So since we're talking about being fearless, right, let's talk about, because this is something that both of us need to do today. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about taking chances.
Okay.
This, which is still under the umbrella of being fearless.
Yes.
Let's talk about things that writers can do to take more chances with their career. Like we were talking with the brothers the other day about going to networking and, you know what I mean, all those different things. Like I've found in the last 2 or 3 years, I've really been getting involved with different committees at the Writers Guild just to keep my face out there. You know, now when there's something going on, people hit me up going, Hilliard, are you going?
Right.
Hilliard, we want you to be there.
Right.
Matter of fact, because I sit in the front seat, people have a seat right there. It's already reserved for me. They know I'm coming. You know what I mean? But so they like, we got you one in the front. Right. Don't even worry about it, you know.
Right, right.
But they like my presence. I'm somebody, I'm not afraid in being fearless to ask a question.
Right.
You know, if there's something going on at a panel, an event or whatever, I'm one of the ones who, if I have a question, mm-hmm. I'll be the first person who starts the whole question
right,
thing going.
Right.
And they like that about me because I'm very, when we have a committee meeting, I'm one of the people who has, you know, anybody have something going on? I have something going on.
Right.
You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. Right.
So let's talk about taking chances for
well,
you.
Well, one of the things I think, and I used to tell this to people all the time, a lot of meetings I go to, like one of the things that really helped open me up and made me really to like want to take a chance, it was going to film festivals outside of LA, away okay. from my comfort zone. Like it's very easy to go to a film festival in LA. There's like mm-hmm. so many of them. But when you start going outside of different states or even other countries, mm-hmm. there's something, I don't know, I think it gives you a rush. And it's true. Very, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, it just makes you... I don't know, it just pumps you up and energizes you to want to make film. It's something about being with other people, especially when you went to like Sundance and a couple other festivals where mm-hmm. you're meeting people from other countries who are jazz and they want to talk about film and just being in that environment, mm-hmm. it's really stimulating.
I can relate
so to one of the things is people have to get over, and one of the fears is people have things being expensive, you know?
Absolutely.
I'm not going to have enough money. Mm-hmm. I had to tell people like, you need to stop putting that out there in the world.
True.
The first time I went, basically, it's like I went in 2007, and I think that was the first year that the Black House was there. I love the Black House. Shout out to the Black House. I love them. Oh my God, that was such a great networking experience. But the idea of just like, I'm going to go. I'm not going to worry about whether how much money I have right now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to plan to go to the next whatever the thing is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start saving up money right now. I'm okay. going to start looking at prices and flights.
So you invested in your career now.
Thank you. And basically, it was the fear of worrying about one and not being able to have time off. Oh my God. Some of the things that people do is not so much money. Mm-hmm. It's also whether at your job you'll be able to have to take the time off to do it. And they're afraid to ask their bosses for that time. Sure. Or they're afraid they're going to get fired. And I just, at that point, I just said, I don't care. You know, I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. But if I give them a year in advance notice, hey, I'm going to be going to the Sundance, I'm going to go to the Austin Film Festival. Mm-hmm. I'm going here and I'm going for a whole week. Mm-hmm. You give people enough notice and you start changing your behavior to save your money up. Because I'm going to be honest with you.
You stay an extra hour here and there or something.
The festivals aren't that expensive. Mm-hmm. They really aren't. Mm-hmm. If your monkey ass wait to the last minute to get your ticket and get a room and all that,
all of a sudden it's $300, $400,
$600. It's really mm-hmm. like literally when I went to Sundance in 2007, mm-hmm. I only spent $1,000 and I was there for a week.
Okay.
That took care of my flight. I think my flight was like 200 something. Mm-hmm. I think the rental of my share, there's like 7 or 8 of us that rented like a tri-level mm-hmm. townhouse thing. Mm-hmm. What a jacuzzi.
Okay.
Shuttle service right in front of the house. We just mm-hmm. walked outside, dropped us off. Right. That's all you needed. Mm-hmm. And whatever, like, souvenirs and stuff. Like literally the cost of the festival itself was, like, maybe in the housing, was, like, $700. The extra $300 I spent.
Mm-hmm. Just food
and
all
maybe
that.
Maybe just buying shit and, mm-hmm. you know, buying, hey, who's got this DVD? Oh, let's go. Hey, let's have a party. And that mm-hmm. was the best thing I ever did is if you ever go to a festival, and especially if you rent, like a house or something like that, which is a lot better than renting a hotel room.
I know, because we have our vacation rentals and people are always having parties in our house. It pisses
us
off.
We would go there and we would say, hey, why don't you guys come over and hang out? And we had like a little dinner spread. You know, we mm-hmm. just got some food, invited some people to come over and hang out and just meet people. And it was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. But before all the years had gone before, I thought about going. The fear was, oh, I'm not going to, it's going to be too expensive. Oh, I'm not going to be able to get the time off. And the year I did it, I was like, I'm fearless. I'm going. Mm-hmm. I put it out there. I'm going. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm going to do. I started looking up, started hooking up. Hey, who else is going out to Sundance? Start mm-hmm. going on message boards. Who's planning on going? Mm-hmm. Just happened to meet some people who were going, set it up, do it, and just did it. And mm-hmm. it was the best thing I ever did. Mm-hmm. Because I made so many connections from Sundance sure. that have lasted me till now. Unfortunately for me, I do a lot of traveling overseas. So a lot of my money is spent eating and being with family. But this year I'm going to try to go out to the Austin Film Festival. Okay. Always wanted to go. Mm-hmm. It looks like a lot of fun. I want to go to Sundance again. And I really just want to go to a film festival and be fair and go to another country. And if it means going by myself, mm-hmm. I'll do it mm-hmm. in a minute because I don't want to miss out on great films and meeting really cool people. And here's the thing I like about going to film festivals outside of LA. People are so much more relaxed. They are so happy to be out of California. Mm-hmm. You would be amazed. You'd be sitting there, and then you'd be amazed that you just sitting there talking to somebody and you realize, oh my God, that's so and so.
That's actually probably, you made a really good point.
Like,
there's
what?
Something about, now you and I have, you know, been in some festivals here with our projects, mm-hmm. and we have judged for mm-hmm. different ones, mm-hmm. whether for their screenplay competitions. Mm-hmm. And some of the film competition. Mm-hmm. There is something about being here and running into a big writer or executive and having a conversation with them at a film festival than it is being in San Francisco
right.
and running into them when they're like kicked back and right. chill. They don't have to go to work tomorrow.
Right.
There's a big, you have a good point about that. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between meeting somebody in the industry outside of town, mm-hmm. which is, this is going to be kind of funny. Which kind of plays into, I always tell everybody, like, I've been in my relationship with my partner, Scott, for 13 years next month. And people always ask me, how do you do it? And I always say, because, number one, it's about communication,
right?
But number two is I always say, all my friends are like, oh, I'm going to Hawaii tomorrow. Oh, I'm going to, you know, I hope I meet somebody, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, you're going to the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And they're like, what do you mean? I says, never fall in love with somebody on vacation. Mm-hmm. Because it's the same thing. You mm-hmm. go there, you meet some agent, some lawyer,
right,
whatever,
right.
on vacation, when you're on vacation for a film festival, and they're on their best behavior.
Right.
They're having a good time.
Right.
They're just being nice.
Right.
You get them home, you see how they really are. You see what I mean? So I always tell everybody, mm-hmm. go there, have fun, do your little whatever you're going to do for the weekend or a week,
right.
but do not go there and be like, oh my God, this is the best person I ever met in my
right.
life. Because they on vacation.
Right.
You don't
and
know
everybody's
what
happy.
They're like. Right.
Right.
So I don't know how that ties into that at all, but I just had to say that because it just always reminds me of that.
Well, I just know that when I was there and we're like, you could just be, we were just standing in line waiting for cocoa, mm-hmm. waiting in line to go to a cafe, waiting in line for something, and you just talk to people. And the fact that you're traveling from wherever you're coming from, mm-hmm. it actually makes you, it's almost like, it's like an aphrodisiac for yourself because it makes you sexy, not I mean sexually, but sexy in a way like, oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. You flew all the way out here. You know, I'm not mm-hmm. saying that they think that you're somebody.
But some people do think you're somebody, though.
But because you're serious about film, that you would travel all the way out mm-hmm. here to come check out some films and be, you know, among different people, it's just exciting.
Yeah.
There's just a different, it's very energizing.
Because I'm going to tell you, as somebody who has my own company, if I was in Sundance and I met some young filmmaker who came in from Idaho or from wherever the fuck, mm-hmm. I'd be like, oh, they serious about coming here.
Mm-hmm.
They drove all the way here
right.
by themselves for 13 hours.
Right.
Whatever it is, I'm like, okay, this person wants it.
Because I was fearful of going to, like, the first time going to Sundance, because it's like, well, I don't have a project in Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
I got a couple of scripts that are, you know, making the rotations or what have you, mm-hmm. but I didn't really have product. And so mm-hmm. a lot of times that prevented me from attending certain things because
sure.
you feel like, I got to have product to be put. I can just be showing up and hanging mm-hmm. out and because people are there to work. And I'm like, to me, it was even more relaxing because I could focus really on what people were saying and be mm-hmm. interested. As opposed, I got the script. That will come later.
Yeah.
But it just felt like once I got over, like, well, so what? I don't have a project right now. Or, you know, I'm just going to go because I want to go see some good films. And
well, let me tell you something. In talking about being fearless, right, I probably have been in about 26 film festivals,
mm-hmm.
right, with my projects. And the ones that I've been to, because I don't go to all of them. Because
mm-hmm.
what happens is you get into a film festival, it does well, and then that film festival from another place, there was a representative there, or they knew somebody else.
Right.
You know, they all know each other.
Right.
So they'd be like, hey, did you have any good films? Oh, yeah, that was this one called this. You guys should.
Right.
You guys should. So all of a sudden, you get a call from this company in Philadelphia, this one in Rhode Island,
right.
or whatever,
right.
and all of a sudden, your film's being shown all over the place.
Right.
And what I've learned is, in being fearless, the people who win the audience award, let me tell you what they do.
What is the secret that they do?
I go, so check it out.
Uh-huh.
So all you filmmakers who have films in film festivals and you want to win that audience award, let me tell you what you do. And I have seen this. Every time I see the person who won the award is you'll see that person walking around throughout the whole film festival and like their film is showing tomorrow at 12 o'clock, even if it's in like a shorts program or whatever, they will be walking around every single person they meet. Hey, come see my thing. It's at 12 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the shorts program one, whatever the
right,
fuck.
Right.
They are like promoting. They got posters up more than everybody
right,
else.
Right.
All that. So you keep seeing it. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't go, you vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You just can't help it because it's been like what do they call it? Subliminal?
Yeah, like it's in your mind. Yeah. Every subconsciously.
I went to at least 12 of the 20-something that I was in, and every person who won was not a lazy person. They weren't just the person who was like, oh, well, my film's in it. We won. No, they were out hustling.
Right.
You know? So just tying in what you were saying about being at Sundance and all these other places, it's kind of cool to go. So if you're not in, you should go to learn your map around.
All right.
To
yeah.
learn how it all works. So when you are blessed to get in, now you know what to do. Because once you're there, you're going to be hustling your butt off, you know,
but
trying to get
so
meetings, trying to do whatever.
Right.
You know, it'd be much better to go with your boys and your girls and have fun and learn the ropes. You know
I met
I mean?
A lot of wonderful actors, really, really good agents, some really cool directors. And they were like really like, I remember who was it? It was a I can't remember his name. He did a lot of, he was big in music videos, and he did a lot of, he was starting to do a lot of films and stuff. And I remember I went to the Blackout, one of their panels they had, and saw him a couple times at parties. And then we were leaving the airport, and I just happened to be in line buying some gum before we got on the plane. I'm like, hey, I came to your panel, and he gave me his card. Like, hey, well, give me a call. I remember we corresponded, and he had another project he was working on and doing some stuff, but it was like that easy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They're accessible.
Just like, he was just like, oh, well, hold on a minute. He says, and I was just like, well, I just wanted to say, oh, no, hold on. Give you my card, let me finish paying for this, and I'm like, okay, you know, and I didn't have anything, but it was like, because I had seen him several times, always said, hey, ran into you again, huh? It's like, are you my special stalker? You know, oh, are you going to the so-and-so? Okay, right, well, did you see that movie? I don't know, just basic conversational, not even trying to like whoop-de-whoop, come look at my screen. It wasn't even like that at all. And until later, it was like, hey, how's it going? Oh man, I really appreciate the panel you guys did, that was really awesome. And yeah, so, you know, if you guys, well, give me your card. Well, hold on, let me give you my card. It was just that simple. And that happened like several times. And there were a couple of people there whose projects really got a lot of play because, like you said, they were hustling. I mean, there were times I was going up and down the boulevard and they were posters everywhere. It's like, oh my God, how many poster things and flyers?
Because I'm telling you, if you ever watch, this is a big shout out to Lena Waithe and Ben Jones over there at the Writers Guild. If you ever watch them promote Dear White People, they are fucking beasts. You wonder why the it's doing well and got distribution and she got an HBO deal and all this. Them motherfuckers hustle their butts off. Okay? I just went a couple weeks ago. Ben had a screening of a sizzle that he did for like a pilot presentation. And soon as they started the thing, before they even started, Lena and Ben got up and went, okay, everybody, get your phones out. Tweet this right now. I mean, they are like so good at that shit. You know what I mean? But that's real.
But
I had to tell.
There's a fearlessness to it. They're like, we don't care.
Yeah, I had to tell Jennifer that. You know, when we were having one of our meetings, I was like, you need to be telling, as soon as we start, everybody needs to be tweeting that they're at the freaking OBS meeting. We need to be letting people know this is going on.
Right.
You know what I mean? And because that stuff is important. You know, you're the Twitter queen. You know what I mean?
I'll be trying to people, you might need to mute
the
me.
The more you hashtag, the more people know what's going on.
You know?
And I'm starting to learn that too.
You're
you know, people are starting to hit us all the time on it just because I'm using the Screenwriters Rant Room
and just
hashtag.
Even with my own writing, it's just a lot of the writing or just information about writing gigs, especially with the fiction and my science fiction, fantasy writing and stuff like that. Just gigs that are open and looking for stuff, Twitter. You know what I'm saying? If I wasn't on Twitter, like, you know, a lot of the stuff I've been submitting to and looking, checking out and getting published in, I didn't know about them until I was on Twitter and I was connected with those people. And those people, too, because I'm like those people, too. It's like, oh, but I don't want people thinking I tweet so much. It's like, I mean, there are people on there who tweet 10, 12 times a day. I'm one of those people now. But it's like, it's very easy. It's not like you have to read every single tweet. But a lot of the people that I follow are people who are in the industry, you know, especially a lot of the screenwriting people who are giving out so much cool information. Child, they putting up scripts and stuff. Somebody the other day just put up the, I used to have a copy of it years ago, and I was like, maybe I should try to look it up again. And someone had put up the Scarface script.
They
were, I think it was the Black, it might have been the Blacklist. And they were just like, hey, we got the script from, hey, with the notes and stuff all on it, you know, and I'm like, let me download this bad boy. They done saved me having to look for stuff. And I'm like, that was just on Twitter.
Sure.
You know, so you have to utilize social media and be fearless. I will have to say that I am fearless when it comes down to Twitter. Although I am trying to tell myself, slow down a little bit, Lisa. You ain't got to tweet about every single little thing. But sometimes stuff will happen. But I'm so interested in so many different things. Mm-hmm. And because I follow so many amazing people, you can't help it. You get pumped up and excited. Mm-hmm. And somebody asks a question about a TV show. But what do you guys think about this? And you just compelled to respond, like, because you never know who's looking at that.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, because I know for a fact, because I listen to so many different shows with showrunners and like co-EPs, and they're talking about how they are on Twitter, you know, when people respond to shit about the show. They want to know what the audience is listening to.
They are watching the hashtags for the show. Like the shows I watch, like Extant, Last Ship, all those genre shows, and they have the East Coast and the West Coast tweeters and stuff like that, and they tweet. Sometimes those writers are on there with them. I know that the writer of Extant, I think last week's episode, they were like, he was live tweeting with the people, and it's like instant feedback. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you just never know who's actually watching it. Because, you know, a lot of times I used to worry, like, oh, I don't want to say anything to offend them. Fuck it. You know, I'm watching the show. This is what I think. You know, put it out there. But do not be afraid to utilize that, because jobs, insider information, that kind of stuff.
All right. This will be the last thing we'll talk about. So we're talking about being fearless. We're talking about investing in your career. We're talking about taking chances. Now let's talk about one of the most important things that is really something that writers don't do enough of: asking for help. Okay, because you hear, I probably get, and this is no joke, 5 emails or Facebook messages, and I probably get another 5 to 10 every week on LinkedIn from somebody asking me to mentor them. Now, that's good. You're asking for help. But let's talk about that for a second, because I think there's certain ways to do that. And I think that but even somebody like the two of us, we're in the industry, we're working, we still need to ask for help sometimes.
Well, I'll give you a quick example that just happened literally like yesterday. Sure. Like, so my Clarion class of 2012, we just, it's open now. You can get it now if you want it. You can pay whatever you want. We have an anthology we put out called The Red Volume, and it's short stories, science fiction, fantasy, short stories, and horror stories. And it's actually a fundraiser for the Clarion Foundation.
Okay.
So we were like trying to figure out a way, like, let's get the word out. We can use social media. And then one of my writer friends was like, well, Why don't you hit up Neil Gaiman and see if we can get Neil Gaiman to tweet about the Red Volume? And so I remember sending a conversation, the emails, like, we were kind of nervous about it. Like, you know, what do we do? And so thank God, I think it was Luke. Hey, Luke Pebler. Hi, Luke. And one of my Clarion comrades hit up, you know, Neil Gaiman. And then the next thing you know, Neil Gaiman's like, well, look at this, the Red Volume. And it's like, fucking Neil Gaiman.
What did he say specifically?
Basically, you need to get this book. You know, check out this book of like, you know, delicious stories. You know, the Red Volume. And like, he has a huge following and he's really well known. And he's a beast with his own writing. But it took that, well, somebody should ask me. Well, maybe we can get him the
tweet. Just get him, even if he favors it, right?
And then he did it. And we were like all high-fiving each other, you know, in the cyberspace. Like, oh, my God, Neil Gaiman just tweeted us. But it took that, well, just ask him. You know, it's like, instead of like, well, maybe. And there was that little nervousness, like, well, who are we to ask this person? And he did it like that. You know what I mean? So that's like a basic, you know, in real time.
But it worked.
And it worked. Yeah. I mean, hopefully people who are fans of his will see that tweet, will hit the hashtag, will pay what you can. It's called The Red Volume. Hashtag Red Volume.
Where can I get it at? Where can I get it?
Just go on. Just look it up on Twitter, Red Volume, or look under my thing. I usually post it up. But it's The Red Volume.
Is it on Google? I mean, Amazon or anything?
It's on, I think it's called Gumroad.
Okay.
It's just, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm gonna be tweeting the hell out of it for the next month or so. But you can pay any amount. If you want to pay $1 for it, for 17 stories, you can pay $1. If you want to pay 10, all the money goes towards the Clarion Foundation, which is to help science fiction fantasy writers become better writers and get better material out into the world. But it was just that small thing, like, well, somebody should ask him. Well, I don't know. We don't know him. Why are we asking him? And then he did it. And it's like, God damn, I'm going to start asking for from now on. You know?
Because, I mean, I talk to a lot of writers. We're living in a really, It's the golden age for television again. Mm-hmm. Yet, for a writer who does not have an agent or a manager, mm-hmm. it's hella hard to get an agent mm-hmm. or a manager. I know of, we were going to have Jenny Frankfurt on soon. She's a big manager. And she talks a lot about how even her medium-level writers who are like, you know, supervising producers
right.
are having a hard time. She's repping them. She's repping them as a manager, but she can't even get them an agent. And they have television
wow.
credits. You know?
Wow.
That's how difficult it's becoming right now, which is why everybody who comes out of program is getting an agent, because the program is like, okay, cool. I mean, the agents are like, okay, cool. The program is doing their best to get them a mentor who's a showrunner on this show,
right.
who's probably going to bring them in next season
right.
for blah, 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 blah. So that takes a little bit off of us.
Right.
Whereas the supervising producer who used to be on the show has to almost start all over again.
Yes.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
So there's a reason why it's coming from the bottom up and not from the top down,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think we were talking earlier before we started taping about the Writers Guild has the feature access program
right.
and they have a TV access program, mm-hmm. Which is mainly for the feature access is pretty much for everybody, mm-hmm. which I think kind of sucks that the TV one isn't,
right.
but the TV one is for like mid-level and above,
right?
You know? And one of the biggest things that always happens, and I found myself over the years getting caught up in it too from time to time, which is you always hear the story that agents and managers are going to come to you. They will find you mm-hmm. when it's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You win Austin, they're going to call you,
mm-hmm.
right? You win Slam Dance, Sundance, you know, they're going to call you.
Mm-hmm.
You have a script that gets in a blacklist, they're going to call you,
mm-hmm.
right? So your job is to try to get on one of those
mm-hmm.
or get to that place.
Right.
Otherwise, that's why you hear stories of some of the best writers in the world who never quite make it.
Right.
Because they just think somebody's going to discover them somehow. But if you're not out there, people don't know.
They're sitting up on the wall waiting for the young person to ask them to dance. And
yeah.
basically, you just need to get on the dance floor and do
get
your thing.
Get your back up off the wall.
What?
Dance. Come on.
Do your thing. And like, oh, they're out here. But if you're sitting there propped up on the wall, like, they're going, mm-hmm. I'm going to sit up here and look all cute and pretty. And they're going, no, they're not doing it anymore.
They don't. And so what happens is a lot of us, I'm just going to include myself for the sake of an argument, a lot of us will need an agent or a manager or anything, and we don't ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling you earlier about one of my mentors. I was telling her about, you know, trying my best to get myself on The Walking Dead.
Right.
On the spinoff.
Right.
And I just happened to be talking to her about it. It just so happens that she knows somebody over at AMC
mm-hmm.
and hit up an email and referred me. I was like, oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, but had I not have said anything,
right.
I wouldn't have gotten a door open.
Right.
You know, so the cool thing is for us to ask. Sometimes you have to ask. All people can say is no. What I don't like is, and we can talk about this for a second. What I don't like is, I was telling you, I'm hit on Facebook and all these other places asking me to mentor them or, hey, read my script or whatever, you know. I literally get people going, hey, I just got one the other day from some kid. Whoever it is, don't even remember his name, saying, hey, you know, love your show, yada, yada, yada. Would you read my script? And if you like it, would you pass it on to any agent or manager or whatever? And I'm going, I don't really know you. You know what I mean? Not yet. You got to build that relationship with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get ones where people are going, hey, here's my script. Can you send it to somebody else? And I'm going, I don't know you.
Right.
It's still the same
right.
scenario. I respect at least the guy said, if you like it, could you?
Right.
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 But then people are going, here it is. Send it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't get a mentor by doing things like that.
Right.
You know, not saying that I'm some special mentor.
Right.
But that would be from anybody who
right.
could mentor you.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, I recently just got that. I had a friend of mine up here who just called me and said, hey, this person, can you call this person? Because they have an idea. And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe there's, you know, some suggestions
sure.
on what to do, but I'm kind of getting the impression that they want me to write the script for them. Like, they just
mm-hmm.
have an idea. It's like, okay, we're missing some steps here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't do everything. But I think there's a certain etiquette to asking for things that you want,
because mm-hmm.
you don't want to come off as an asshole and burn bridges and people not like you. And I think that's where the networking part needs to come in. Mm-hmm. And I think people are not willing to network. It's kind of like what what's his name was talking about in his book about the TV writing. Mm-hmm. And basically how...
Shout out to Gray Jones.
Hi, Gray. there's this disconnect in terms of actually doing the work itself. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's kind of like, I got the script. I can just find somebody to do it for me. You need to learn how to build a relationship. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the biggest... mess up and things that people are missing right now. Because there's nothing wrong with like building a relationship with somebody and, hey, I saw you at this thing. And by the way, if you happen to know anybody, do you know of any places I can send this? You know? And depending on what your relationship status is and what type of networking you've done with this individual, then it might be, well, hey, well, send me your script. Let me see what you have. They're missing the intricate steps. You know, they want to go like from A to Z, but just from A to B. You know, and they haven't gone in the steps in between. So I think one of the things that we're going to have to, like, teach ourselves to do is, one, not to be afraid to ask for what we want, but to ask in the appropriate manner.
Yes.
Okay?
That is important.
We are not doing
People
that.
People misunderstand that.
We are not doing that. Uh-huh. And I think that is the biggest lesson, because we can talk about being fearless and, hey, just go ask anybody, but then it makes you look stupid. Okay? There's the steps in between. So the biggest thing we talked about is doing the whole networking thing and not being creepy about it. I guess that's the word I'm looking for, because there's been situations I've seen people and they're just like years ago, we had a person that would come to like some of the OBS meetings and stuff, and they were just like making these demands. It's like, first of all, no one knows you. Like, come participate in some things. Come, you know, do some work, like, you know, polish your script, do this. It was like, here's my script, come do it. And just remember that that person just got ostracized to the point where they were just asked, like, geez, don't come here no more. Like, it got to that point. And it was
they
like,
went Tom Petty on
it. Okay, it's like, yeah, don't come around here no more. Stop giving. No, it's like, don't. So please, people listening to this, yes. Be fearless. Get out there. Introduce yourself. But learn how to network and to cultivate relationships. I mean, that might be something we need to talk about another episode on how to cultivate a mentor-mentee relationship. Yeah. But
well, let me tell you.
Yeah.
I told you because I do, you know, some of these pitch fest things like Sherwood Oaks and all these other things. And there are literally, they literally tell them, do not give your scripts to people. Do not do this, do not do that, and it will end, and I can't tell you how many people will sneak up to me
because this is what they
and
think.
Try to hand me
this
an envelope with a full script inside.
This is what
it.
They think. I know they just said that, but I'm special.
Yeah, it's entitlement.
I'm not like these other jokers.
Mine is good.
I am the one who is going to take King Arthur's sword and pull it out of that rock. Excalibur is mine, and it is, and it's like, no.
See, the problem is everybody hears those stories. I was just listening to a podcast the other day. I think it was Gray Jones' show. And he was interviewing this guy who, for like years, he was like an assistant on different shows. And I guess he was working for some big company. And he kind of learned the way around and literally took his script and dropped it off to, you know, some big executive and put it like in the pile and walked away. And because nobody was in the office or something. And sure enough, all of a sudden he gets a call to come into the office and they're like, did you write the script? Because such and such wants to see you. You know, and he thinks he's in trouble, and then it ended up working out
right,
for him.
Right, right.
And so people hear those stories that you're supposed to be that fearless.
Right.
Right. But he was talking about how he worked the game. He didn't just like pop into some agency and leave his thing on a desk.
Right.
He was in the system working at this company and learned that there's that stack and that room that this agent or this whoever he is would go and look at whenever he was like, okay, now I don't have anything else to look at. I need to see what's in this pile.
Right.
And he would put it, he would keep moving it up so it became the one that was at the top.
Right, right.
You know, which I thought was pretty big.
Right.
But he figured out the system.
Right.
And a lot of young writers hear stories like that and think that they need to do something similar.
Right.
But they missed the steps he was talking about.
Exactly. Like, for me, with my relationship with Pilar, her being one of my favorite mentors, is the fact that, one,
we're going to be doing her show soon.
You know, was going, taking her glasses. Two, whenever she was going to speaking at an event, going to that event, taking my notes and being studious. And because of that, you know, she remembered my writing and work. I got invited into her private writing group. which is really hard to get into. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after about, like, maybe let's say about like a year or two afterwards, was finally asking her, hey, I know you do these script writing, you know, the conventions and mm-hmm. stuff. Could I just come work for you? Like, next time you do that, could I be your assistant?
That's the way to do it.
You know, because at the time I thought, well, I don't know if I'll be able to, I mean, afford. I mean, I think it was pretty inexpensive, mm-hmm. but
shit adds up, though.
I wanted to have access to other things. I think this is during the time they started charging for every single little thing, mm-hmm. but I wanted to be able to have access to other things. And mm-hmm. one way to do that is by being the assistant and getting that pass to be able sure. to get everywhere. But it took some time, mm-hmm. you know, and before I finally said, okay, I feel comfortable enough. It's like, you know what, Pilar, I really would like to go check out, you know, is there a way I can come work for you? And she said, well, yes. Mm-hmm. And that was the year that when I went, one of the years I went and worked for her was the year that I got to see Frank Darabont. And that's when I was fearless and did the whole, walked up to him and said, I want to buy the mist from you. And he's like, you got $1 million? I'm like, no, can I come be an-? And that's when I was not persistent yeah. and fucked that yeah. up. But that relationship with Pilar, it wasn't like I just went to one of her classes and said, hey, can I just be, mm-hmm. first of all, she didn't know me from Adam. Mm-hmm. So me come up and say, hey, can I be your personal assistant person to help you when you're teaching mm-hmm. these classes with these people who are paying this money and mm-hmm. coming over to be with her? No, it took some time for me to develop a relationship. Number sure. one, she had to know who I was, what mm-hmm. my work ethic was. Two, she had to know what my work was mm-hmm. and the screenwriting class. And one, whether or not she liked me or not. Like, can I trust this person can, like, represent me?
Sure.
You know, because I had to, like, add, you know, and I remember she said, well, you have to be able to do the DVD stuff because it's technical stuff and be able to do the DVD. And when I ask for the clip, you got to be right on it and mm-hmm. do that thing. I'm like, I can do that, mm-hmm. you know? And she said, well, come on. And I had so much fun doing that, mm-hmm. you know, because, one, I had developed a relationship mm-hmm. and I let her see that I wasn't just some little, you know, precious sure. snowflake, flaky person. Sure. And then asking for what I wanted. I wanted to get access to everything that the
and
convention
that gave you access to her.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. And being with her and her knowing my work and mm-hmm. knowing me over time, over a couple of years, because sure. very easily I could have been like, okay, I've taken a couple classes. I just got in her writing group. And now I can ask her, hey, do you mind? No, it was like, let her see my work, mm-hmm. you know, hang out, get to know her so she knows me and trustworthy mm-hmm. and stuff. And then I felt comfortable enough after about 2 years and said, I know you do these big conventions. Can I come and do that?
Absolutely.
Because in my mind, it was like, I need access to these other places. And because of that relationship and cultivating it and then asking for what I wanted, mm-hmm. I was able to get that. So that's kind of like how you kind of should
yeah,
work that.
There were steps.
Yeah, there were, you know? Yes, people, I didn't just go from A to Z. I had to go A, B, C, D, E, F, G and uh-huh. keep going on until I felt that she, you know, that I was worthy and that I was comfortable enough to be able to ask her for that. Mm-hmm. You know, by then it was like, Lisa, you don't need to be taking my class. And I would, like, I would be in her private writing group, but every now and then she would do, like, a special, like, rewrite class at a special event somewhere. And I would show up at the class, and she'd be like, what are you doing here? And I said, you just don't know. Sometimes I just need that quick pick-me-up. You're like my crack. I need that quick pick-me-up. She's like, you know all my tricks. I said, yes, but I still want to be in the room and enjoy that stuff. So she just teased me all the time, like, what are you doing here? And then she asked me with a bunch of other select writers, too, when she did her DVD on the page. And that's when she said, hey, come be in this DVD. Mm-hmm. And so if you get the DVD, if you get the on-the-page DVD by Pilar Alessandra, right? And if you look in there, and this is another thing I did. Mm-hmm. This is how you ask what you want, and then you slip stuff in there. So when I did the DVD, you'll see me in there. That was when I had just cut off my dreadlocks. I was rocking a fro with my mm-hmm. little glasses. I was just total, like, nerd look. But then in the middle of the DVD, I made sure I asked a question and talked about my Griselda Blanco script so that it was on the DVD so that anybody in the industry who was looking at that DVD would, one, remember my name because it's listed on the DVD, and two, get a little mini pitch of my script. Sure. So it was kind of like I was working this. I was layers on top of layers.
Well, that's what's up, y'all. That's what's up. So today's episode, again, was about being fearless, you know, just kind of investing in your career, asking for help, you know, taking chances, you know, shit like that. And today was kind of a needed episode. Like I said, I was kind of in a mood today. I actually feel really good right now.
Oh, good. You I'm glad we were able to lift that
yeah,
a little
sometimes
bit.
You just kind of talk yourself through it.
Right.
And you just feel like.
Because when we get done with this, I'm heading over to Venice Beach to go do my walk.
Good.
I love it over there. Craziness and that energy. So, yeah, mm-hmm. definitely.
So the next thing we're going to get into before we leave is we're going to do the Don't Sleep On Him segment. Mm-hmm. And I decided, I was telling her, since I was feeling the way I was feeling today, I decided we're going to read something from mine.
Okay.
Right. We're going to do something from you, too. We're gonna, it's coming up.
Maybe. You know what? Maybe I'll do maybe a page from the my Bitches Brew sex script.
Okay.
Sex worker script. And just put it out in the world and just let it go, Lisa.
So we're going to read something from mine. This is from a short, like, kind of a suspense one that I did that I actually, God, I've been optioned like 3 times on this little short script from producers who wanted to shoot like a really cool suspense action film. And it's called 9 Below Zero. And it's about a hitman is forced to make a life or death decision when his work becomes personal. And very character driven, you know, trippy little short film that maybe at some point I might even direct myself. We'll see. So I'll read all the dialogue, and we'll read it to page 2. You see where it ends?
Right, when it cut
right
off.
There? Mm-hmm. Cool? Mm-hmm. So it's called 9 Below Zero. Here we go. Oh, just so you guys know.
That would be helpful.
I might not have set this up very well, but this is the Don't Sleep On Them segment. This is a segment we usually do when we promote, like, some young writer who, you know, what? Cool writer?
Yeah, brand new newbie, someone to look for in the future. Like, yeah. They've got something, and we want to make sure that you know what they got.
Yeah, and I guess just in the wake of me feeling good about myself, I was like, well, I was just scrolling through some of my scripts, and I pulled this one out today, and I was like, fuck it, let's just read something to mine, you know, just so you guys see what we do. So here we go, 9 Below Zero.
Fade in, exterior, somewhere in the mountains, just before dawn. Dense forest, as far as the eye can see. White snow covers towering evergreens like a blanket. Voices emanate, but can't clearly be heard. Clump, 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 the sound of boots cut into thick snow. Whip behind 4 men trenching in a strong formation. The big man in front holds a rifle tight to his waist, ready to blast anything that moves. Heath, the short Weasley man in a dark hoodie, second to the last, fights for oxygen. He clutches a shovel tightly, using it to support his weight in the snow.
All I'm saying is, if this guy was trapped in a building with 50 cops surrounding him, no fucking way he got out of there. What'd he do, vanish in the fucking dust?
Closer, on the back of the large man in the rear, in the dark street clothing, clearly not a style you'd wear to the office, he balls his fist. Boom. Heath jerks forward, falls out of line, drops the shovel, and crashes flat on his face. The two in front halt. Heath looks up, strains. From his POV, the man in the rear stares back. This is Kane, a heavy-set, scary son of a bitch.
Just shut the fuck up and keep moving. It's fucking 9 Below Zero, for Christ's sake.
The two up front snort and snicker as Kane blows smoke from his stubby cigarette into the frosty air. Off Heath, pathetically dusting himself off. Exterior, the forest just after dawn. The sun appears over a large clearing. It's straight out of a movie. Santa Claus could fly by at any second. The 4 men group. Some holy shit looks as they take in a family of deer feeding across the ravine. On Heath, reaching into the pocket of the jacket and the pocket of the guy in front of him and slipping something into his own jacket. Kane steps to the front of the line, checks the area, and gives Heath a subtle nod that the brothers can't see.
This is it, boys. Here's where we buried that cocksucker.
All right.
And there we go. So, this short... It ends up going on later on after this. What happens is it was kind of all of a setup.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy called The Mouth, who we're about to meet in a minute, who is like this famous hitman who nobody's ever met before.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay him like secretly through different ways, but nobody ever knows how he picks up the money
right.
or whoever. And they go up there and they think that he thinks he's going to have to kill the other two guys who are with him.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is it was all a setup just to get them up there to get the mouth to come so that they can kill the mouth so that they can tell everybody that they killed them so that they can get the reward
right,
that everybody's
right,
trying to get.
Right.
So this is the whole setup, just setting up the tension and the curiosity of who these guys are and what's going on. Because after this, we're about to meet the other two guys who are in the group.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to read like the whole opening scene leading up to them finally getting to the place where everything's about to go down.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, I like how the writing, how you've got it like set up here, because there's a lot of like action sounds and movement in here. And I kind of get the feel, especially when you're talking about the very first lines and they're talking about white snow covers towering evergreens like a blanket. Mm-hmm. And you hear the clump clump, which is the sound that your feet would make in the snow.
Sure.
So you're setting up a lot of sensory material for people who are reading this script. So you're getting a feel for the environment that they're in. And it kind of sets you up, because when you think about dealing with heavy snow, mm-hmm. lots of heavy stuff, mm-hmm. that restricts a lot of movement. So if anything is about to go down crazy, mm-hmm. in my mind I'm thinking, shit, if this was me and you in here with all this stuff and you're already fighting for oxygen, mm-hmm. if anything is going to happen, it's going to be kind of difficult, because yeah. you're not in the regular terrain at this moment. So it kind of gives you like a sense of like foreshadowing and tension okay. on the first page. Mm-hmm. It's just really subtle in the back mm-hmm. of my mind. As a reader, I'm thinking, shit's about to go down.
Well, it should.
And home dude is already having, you know, problems breathing and stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And you're also setting up the personalities too. You've got like short Weasley man in a dark hoodie mm-hmm. that's very clear and very sharp in terms of what he looks like. Mm-hmm. And then you've got like, you know, the large man in the rear and that kind of thing, heavy set, scary son of a bitch. So you've really got them kind of distinct. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times when you have several characters that you're meeting on the first couple of pages, sometimes you lose track when you're trying to track characters. Mm-hmm. You've got some really good descriptions of them that'll help me remind me, like, this is who this person is.
Well, it's funny, we didn't continue reading, but when we meet the next two guys, Reese and Widow, here's how I describe them. I'm just going to read it for the sake of an argument. But it says, reveal Reese and Widow. No description needed. Just picture two 1% bikers on the most wanted list with rap sheets long as elephant trunks.
That's all you need.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You didn't have to describe any clothing,
exactly.
any physicality, like, you know, to differentiate them between each other. Like, well, he's got the red hair. The mm-hmm. but no, it's just, you don't need no description on them. Yeah. Just know that these dudes, they trouble,
mm-hmm.
you know? And just by the names Reese and Widow, like Widow, you know, subconsciously I'm thinking Black Widow.
Exactly.
I'm thinking Widow Death, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like Reese and Widow, like these, you're not messing with these dudes.
Yeah, because what happens is we show Heath reaches into his pocket and steals something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what he stole from Widow was a Black Widow lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the emblem of the Black Widow
right.
on, and he lights it for Kane later on, uh-huh. and then all shit goes down.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's one of those things where just a bunch of little subtle things mm-hmm. are like sprinkled in.
Yeah, you're putting in a lot of descriptive words and things mm-hmm. that are doing a lot of work without having to put a lot of lines in there to carry yeah. that load and what you're trying to describe.
And you talked about the snow.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted something that was like a real backdrop
mm-hmm.
to character. I wanted to be like part of the character,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. You know, as mm-hmm. we go along, the snow slows them down a
right.
lot. When the hitman comes in and it gets into a big battle, there's blood everywhere on the snow,
right?
You know what I mean? Like lots of little things that you see across the ravine. You know, a mm-hmm. family of deer. Just lots of little things that mm-hmm. sprinkle in.
And then the description you put on here, you talk about the deer, but also Santa Claus could fly at any second.
Oh, yeah,
so yeah, it's straight out of a movie. So we've all seen those beautiful,
mm-hmm.
you know, scenes of the snow and mm-hmm. all of that. So just by saying that, Santa Claus could fly by day minute, I don't need a lot of description about what I'm seeing. It's like,
sure.
oh, it's like those beautiful like Christmas scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous, family of deer. That's all I needed to yeah. put me there in that scene already.
And what it was, even though this is a short film, you know, we're only on the top of page two by mm-hmm. the time you get to that moment, it really was about setting up, like, in every time you see a movie, before shit hits the fan,
mm-hmm.
you see something beautiful.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So it was like, wow, look at this. Dun, dun, dun.
Those
you know
to me
I mean?
Are always, and to me, this is just a side
sure.
note for me when I see films like that or anything. When I see really beautiful, like, landscapes and beautiful stuff, and mm-hmm. then really messed up stuff happens, mm-hmm. it's even more visceral because you've got, like, that juxtaposition of the beauty and then the horror of it. It's kind of like why one of my favorites, classic favorite horror movies, when we talk about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
oh, yeah.
you've got those beautiful, like, bucolic settings, and it's just beautiful, and yet you've got these horrible things happening. So anytime you can juxtapose two images that don't seem to go together with beauty and something with horror, those always, they just do something subconsciously to the viewers. Like, oh, God, mm-hmm. this horrible. It makes it even more horrible. The mm-hmm. fact that we got this beautiful snow in your script, and you're talking about eventually we're going to have all this blood and stuff on mm-hmm. there. It's like, oh, God, and the beauty and, you know. That hits me in the gut.
But that's some irony in it, though.
Right,
you know,
right.
I like that.
It's like,
cool.
That's how life really is. Like, you got this beauty, and something messed up can happen,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. But this script did pretty good for me. You know, like I said, I've had three different options on it from companies, but the problem is because it takes place in the snow in the mountains, getting that, getting a place that you could do that in, mm-hmm. where, because there's, once the mouth comes in, there's lots of gunfire and, mm-hmm. you know, bodies floating and shit. So it becomes a little costly.
And unfortunately, the last couple of years, there hasn't been any, because I know a lot of times people will film up in Big Bear, mm-hmm. where I usually work. Sure. I remember for a while there at the X-Files, I used to come out and film parts of the forest scenes. And because there were times when I was like driving down to go to get something, it's like, I got to turn around and go back, because why? Mm-hmm. Hey, filming X-Files up here. Mm-hmm. We have had like a really bad, like, drought, so there hasn't been any real snow. Yeah. So most of the times I'll film stuff up like Big Bear, because like, oh, it's close by, and there's we ain't had no snow, so I can see why.
Yeah, I've been through, like, we were starting to scout. I mean, at one point for one of the films that I was going to work with, one of the companies, and you know, just never happened yet.
This is the excuse to go film it at Sundance. Make it a working networking vacation. Go to Sundance with the snow and the skiing, and then go to the film festivals.
So that was for the Don't Sleep On Them segment. That was a little something of mine. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Go ahead, quick, for the Nine Below. How many pages was this, the entire script?
9 or 10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that.
Yes, that's how we like them short.
Yeah, I don't usually do them more than 12.
Yeah.
If it's a short.
Yeah, that's something that people need to take in consideration when you're doing short films. Mm-hmm. You don't want to go over 15 minutes because you lose the attention of the people. Mm-hmm. And people are like ADHD right now. You know, our brains are going really fast, and there's a lot of material out there. So if you're thinking about doing a short script yourself, try to keep it like, you know, no more than like 10 minutes or so, because you know, anything longer, you're going to lose your audience because there's just too much material to look at. But if you got something like short, cute, tight, and really, really, really good, it does a lot better, especially in the film festivals and things like that.
Well, cool. That's what's up, y'all. So I just wanted to give you guys a little something, you know, from mine, one of my scripts. You know, like I said, the script did really well. You know, we'll see one day we'll make this sucker happen. Maybe I'll direct it at some point because it's very stylized.
Let's just go to Sundance. You know,
and shoot a gorilla.
We'll shoot it gorilla style.
Have gunfire going and everything.
You know, there's a couple of like celebrity actors there. Just have them stand there. Hey, how's it going? And we'll be like, what was it? What's that movie with Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin?
Oh, and Steve Martin. Bullfinger.
We'll do it just like... Hey, Colin Firth, would you just stand right there for a second? And go.
Girl, you are silly. That's all I'm going to say. You straight up crazy. So, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Where can they find you at, Lisa Cole Jen?
I am on Twitter. Don't follow me.
And I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. And you guys can hit me up at screenwritersrantroom@gmail.com. Hit me on Twitter at ScreenwritersRR or Hilliard Guess on Twitter, as we like to say.
Twitter.
So thank you guys again. Hope you enjoyed the episode. And we will catch you guys next week. Keep it street. Keep it opinionated. And keep it what?
100.
Peace, y'all.
Ciao.
Yeah, man, I got something to get off my chest. Everyone got one. What's your opinion? This is the Rant Room. Tongues won't be bitten. Ain't no rules, just spill it. And anybody can get it. No limit. We get to kill it. You tuning into the thrillers. And no, ain't no stopping. Any topic, even the random.
We get to win.
I hope that you're ready. We entering in the zone soon. We only grown shit. Welcome to the Rant Room.